Do continue. Our miracles never cease. Well, to apply that another way, we're certainly glad to know the Lord's word still is effective and works, and the interest and concern shown Saturday by these two brethren who went over. And other instances such as that we have seen is certainly encouraging, and for that we're all grateful, I'm sure, and thankful. Good to see each of you tonight and to have you here in our studies, and we trust that our coming together might be profitable spiritually to all of us. We're in the book of Daniel. And in that book, there are some things that we have not touched on yet. And before we conclude, I suppose we should bring these matters out because they are important. And if we do not touch on them now, you will probably have an occasion someday to have them brought up to you. And so I think we better touch on those at this time. For we're going to go into part of that tonight in our study, and then some of it we've already covered without going into detail about it. I'm speaking about the abominations of Daniel. Now, this is mentioned by Christ. It's also mentioned here in Daniel several times, and it would be well for us to make a note of the fact that the abominations of Daniel are not one, but they're two. Now, it's mentioned four times, but as it's mentioned, we notice that they have different applications, so that there's not one abomination, there's two spoken of, and we must know the setting of those to understand what he's talking about and when he's talking about it. Now, the first one of these in Daniel 8, verse 13. He speaks of the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. Now, we're going to talk about that tonight, even though in chapter 12. But we're going to talk about that because it has to do with the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So the transgression of desolation has to do, as he says here, with the sanctuary and the host. Now, the next time is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. And here it says, they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. So something's going to be placed somewhere. This again is the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and it refers to something which at this time has already long since passed, as well as all these have, of course, and we're going to talk about that again tonight too. However, there's another one mentioned in chapter 12, verse 11, and here it says, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up. So then something is to be taken away, and something placed in its stead. There shall be 1,290 days. This is in Daniel 12:11, and talks again about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So three times these have talked about Antiochus and the events we're talking about tonight. But the other one is one which was at that time down quite a ways in the future. It happened in 70 A.D. It's found in Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 and 27. Here it says, until the end of the war, desolations are determined, and for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. Now, that is referred to by Jesus in Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16, when he says, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Here he's talking about something that happened a long time after the first three mentions of the abomination of desolation. Now, the first three of those we have referred to, they happened in the time span we're going to talk about tonight. But the fourth of these, mentioned in Daniel 9, was to take place in 70 A.D., and of course, all these now have already taken place. So keep that in mind because, like I said, if we don't go into a lot of detail tonight, someday perhaps you may find nonetheless an opportunity to look into these matters because there are some misunderstandings in the world around us about this very matter. Our thoughts tonight are to begin with chapter 10 of the book of Daniel, and we continue on through chapter 10 through the entirety of the book tonight, chapter 12, and should find some very interesting and very long and involved readings in these verses. Chapter 10 tells us we're talking about the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. This should be about the year 536 B.C., if we have our calculation correctly. And verse 14 says, I am now come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. So Daniel is told that something is going to occur many days ahead, and I'm come to tell you about it. Now, verse 11, we have an introduction. We have an instruction from Gabriel to Daniel. He tells us, in effect, in verse 20, that Persia is to be followed by Greece. So, as we looked on the right-hand board last night, and it's been erased, of course, I erased it myself last night, We had four kingdoms which were to arise on the earthly scene. There was Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. In the days of the Roman Caesars, there was to be a stone symbolically cut out of the mountain without hands. It was to touch the image on the feet, which was Rome, and to break the image into pieces, but it was to spread throughout the entire world and to stand forever. And that, of course, is the Lord's church. Now, in order to continue this same thought we see in chapter 2, we've seen in the following chapters a number of things that repeat themselves. Chapter 7, for an example, gave us the same picture again, but expanded it even beyond what the second chapter did. Chapter 8 talks to us again about the same picture and does not go quite as far as chapter 7, but gives more detail than chapter 2 did. Now, as we continue on down, chapter 9 tells us about the coming of Jesus Christ and ties that in with chapter 7 because chapter 7 also predicted that. Now, tonight, chapter 11 and 12, particularly chapter 11, is going to, in effect, pick up chapter 8 again and go much, much more in detail about chapter 8, give you a much more complete picture of it, and then give a fitting conclusion to the effects of what he's been talking about. So we're really going to find ourselves repeating what we have already talked about, but in more detail, so we can be emphatically sure of what we're talking about. And then, of course, tomorrow night, we'll proceed to the book of Revelation. If you will read chapter 1, you probably need to read chapters 2 and 3 also. I don't know how far we get in chapter 1, but probably all the way through it. So I'd like for you to read chapters 2 and 3. Now, in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 16, and Daniel chapter 9, verse 21, we refer to Gabriel. And then in chapter 10, 13, and Daniel 10, verse 21, again, there's a reference probably to Gabriel. He does not tell us for certain who it is. The name's not mentioned, but he refers to some things that allows us very clearly to tie in with Gabriel, who was just mentioned. And then chapter 10 and verse 13, and chapter 10, verse 21, and chapter 12, verse 1, refer to Michael. So we have two angels under consideration in chapter 10. Now, Michael, mentioned in chapter 10, verse 13, is the only angel ever mentioned in the Bible as being an archangel, the only one. That might seem to be a little unusual, but that's the way it's written. However, we do find that, and that was in Jude, verse 9, we do find that he's spoken of in Revelation 12, verse 7, as being Michael and his angels. Now, the fact that he shows his as a pronoun referring to himself, but also perhaps showing possession, since the next word shows something it refers to, might well let us illustrate that Michael here is spoken of as a chief angel or an archangel. And partly that is true because in the same reference, we find that he's spoken of as one of the chief angels. But if he's mentioned as merely one of chief angels, we wonder then if the others were not archangels too, but just were not referred to that way. Don't mean to confuse you. But the fact is, he's the only one mentioned as an archangel, but he's spoken of as one of the chief angels. So if there were chief angels, likely we had more than one archangel, but he's the only one actually referred to by that term. Now, the context of Daniel 10, verse 13, and also 21 and 12, verse 1, indicates a conflict of some kind. Let me repeat that. The context of Daniel 10, verse 13, and verse 21, as well as 12 and verse 1, indicate there might have been some kind of a conflict going on. And we'll see what that has to say. Verse 10 tells us, "And behold, an hand touched me, which set to me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hand." So someone is touching, or something is touching Daniel. Verse 13 says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me." Now, the one consideration is speaking. This, of course, was no doubt Gabriel. And for 1 and 20 days, "But lo, Michael, one of these chief princes, came to help me, and I remain there with the king of Persia." So we have a conflict of some kind going on in which Gabriel is involved, and he says, "Michael, one of the chief angels, came to help me." So we have Michael and Gabriel working together, and for some reason they were involved in some type of a conflict. He mentions the prince of the kingdom of Persia. So there was some kind of conflict going on that we're not told of. So, of course, I don't have the right or the insight to speculate as to what it was, except for the fact that something was going on that Gabriel and Daniel needed to be involved with together. And it seems to me, if I may suggest this, that it may well have been, since they were dealing with Persia, and since they're going to say in the very last part of verse 13, "And I remained there with the kings of Persia," he goes ahead and tells us here that Greece is going to take over, that it may well have to do with the fall downfall of Persia and the coming in of Greece. He doesn't tell us specifically that, but in the book of Daniel chapter 5, verse 21, it says, as you well know, that the Lord's purpose in his ruling as he does in the kingdom of men has been seen time and time again. So God may well be dealing with the kingdoms of men, with the rulers of men here, through Gabriel and Michael in this chapter. Of course, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14 says, "Are the angels, are then all the ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be the heirs of salvation?" Now that means, of course, they could well deal with those in authority, but also is a great deal of assurance in knowing that they deal and have to do with us through the heirs of salvation. Then in Matthew 18, verse 10, Jesus, while speaking here, gives us quite a bit of comfort when he says, "Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." So we notice that there are angels all around us for the protection and well-being of God's people who shall be heirs of salvation. That's true of little ones, and that's true of those who are saints of God. Chapter 10 primarily then tells us about those events that we have just suggested and give us now a reason to go on into chapter 11. Verse 20, however, of chapter 10 really concludes the thoughts I had in mind. "When I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come." So really the ultimate end of chapter 10 is to tell us that Persia is going to fail and Greece is going to come on the scene. We've already seen that, of course, in previous chapters. Now, chapter 11 tells us about Greece being on the scene. He tells us about things that are taking place and are now about to come to an end as Rome comes on the scene. Now, finally, verse 1 tells us, "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth." Gabriel still speaking. "Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." So Persia now is about to act in such ways that Greece is going to come on the scene. Persia is going to fail. Greece will be prominent, and then Greece will fail too, or will fall too. You see, we mentioned this all the way from chapter 2. So really, in the book of Daniel, we're talking about those events which took place. They were to take place, but now they have taken place between the time of Malachi and Matthew. These really are the 400 silent years where there were no prophecies or predictions or insight. And so Daniel does not give us historical facts because it hadn't happened. But Daniel tells us in prophetic terms what was to occur. So we go to secular history and try to find out what it confirmed as to what the Bible had to say. So there are going to be three kings rise in Persia. Daniel has already been told in chapter 10, verse 1, that these things were long. And verse 14 says, "Now I'm come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days." I want you to note that we're talking about God's people primarily. Others will be involved, but primarily it has to do with God's people and those who at that time were considered by Daniel as the children of God, the Israelites. Now, three kings were to arise in Persia, he says, followed by the fourth king, which was to be far richer than they all. Cyrus was the one then reigning, as we noticed in the verse we had just read. So, since Cyrus was reigning, we don't count him. There'll be three kings yet to follow him. So, Cyrus doesn't count in this number. The next one to follow him was Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus. He reigned for 7 years and 5 months, so history tells us. The next, in turn, was Smerdis, who was an impostor. He was not the rightful reign, rightful one to reign, but nonetheless he injected himself into the line, and he was able to reign until he was deposed for 7 months. And then after him there was Darius, the son of Hastapes. He was the son-in-law of Cyrus. He married Cyrus's daughter, who was named Mandane, and he reigned for 36 years. And then following him was a man the Bible speaks of as Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus you read of quite often in the book of Esther, for he was her husband. He was a mighty king the Bible speaks of as reigning over 127 provinces, stretching all the way from India on one end down to Ethiopia on the other. And this man has a very long history in secular history, very interesting history, because you know of him there as Xerxes. You don't know of him as the Bible calls him, but the secular term is Xerxes. Of course, you remember that from your study in history. And then verse 2 says, by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up his realm against Grisha. Now, the interesting thing is that Xerxes was indeed a mighty king, and it is he who's going to be on the scene to intimidate Greece and to cause Greece to come over and conquer the Persians. But the fact is, he died 100 years before Alexander came on the scene. So it's not talking about him personally doing this. It's simply telling us that it is the greatness of his kingdom, the riches of it, the glory of it, that's going to entice Alexander to want to conquer it. And of course, Alexander does. But this is the king that is going to be of that nature. Now, the introduction to Greece, as we have seen earlier, is as this goat, or as the one who was the brass on the image in chapter 2. Now, verse 3 tells us that a mighty king shall stand up. Now, this mighty king, of course, has to be Alexander, because he's in that nation which is going to take over the realm of things. Verse 3, a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Showing, of course, he's going to have a mind of his own and want to do as he wants to, and he will, of course. In 334 B.C., Alexander led his army eastward, and he challenged Persia, and, of course, eventually conquered it, and in the world to the east of that as well. Now, as we continue on from verse 3, I want you to notice carefully, we're going to talk about he and him over and over and over and over and over and over again. I said it that way because that's exactly the way it is. There's no end to the he's and him's. Now, normally, when you read an English sentence, as we Americans do, we can usually tie in the pronoun he or him to the subject of that sentence. And sometimes we don't have the name mentioned, but in the next sentence, the word he will take up from where the sentence before left off. So we know who we're talking about. That's not so here. This chapter is so mixed up with he's and him's and pronouns, you don't know what's going on. Actually, literally. You know, I have never tried this. I'd love to get a real good college English professor to try to tell me which is the subject of these pronouns. I doubt they could do it, because it's not written that way. So, don't be confused. We're going to go to secular history. We're going to try to show what the he's and him's refer to, but don't get confused by saying, well, Harry, you're not right because the subject is not here. Well, I know it's not. It's not intended that way. Now, we continue on with verse 4. When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. Of course, you remember that in our study last night, we showed that Alexander was to die. His kingdom was to be divided into four parts, and it says that in the next clause, and not to his posterity, his children did not inherit, as we saw last night, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. So you see, we're repeating, really, chapter 8. That's exactly what we're doing thus far. But we're going to go much, much more in detail and lay a foundation for chapter 12. The king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. What happened, very simply, as we had mentioned last night, is that Alexander, when he died at an age of almost 33, 32 in about 8 months, almost 33, he did not have any posterity carry on. Now, he had a wife, and she was murdered by his wife, Roxanna. He had a half-brother and his half-brother's wife, and that brother began to rule for a while. But Olympus, who was Alexander's mother, had him killed. He was a half-brother to Alexander. And then Olympias was killed by the soldiers, and so that eliminates her. Alexander had a son whose name was Alexander Agus, and his mother, who was Roxana, were slain by the order of Cassander. Now, that's one of the men you recall who took over one of the four sections of the Greek Empire. And then some 2 years later than that, Alexander's other son, Hercules, and his mother, who was Barsani, who was a daughter of Darius, was murdered by someone too. And so here we have his entire family wiped out. So he has nobody to take over, as you know from our study last night. And of course, it's the Bible here very plainly tells us. And it tells us that his kingdom is going to be divided into four sections. Now, these four sections were to be Macedon and Greece, which is in the proper area of where Greece was. Macedonia would be to the north. This was to be controlled by the general whose name was Cassander. Then Thrace, or Bulgaria, as we know it today in our language, and Bithynia, which is Armenia, as we know it today, was by Lashkamas. And then Egypt was to be controlled by Ptolemy Soter, S-O-T-E-R. Now, that's the first one. There have been numerous Ptolemies, and so don't be confused when I mention that term again. This man's going to die. He'll be succeeded by others. So Ptolemy is P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. Soter is S-O-T-E-R. Now, Ptolemy is like a term for Caesar or Antiochus, or a term that would be used by a number of different rulers in the same reign of a certain country. Syria now is going to be controlled by one of his generals called Seleucus Nicator. Now, Seleucus is L-E-L-E-U-C-I-U-S. Nicator is N-I-C-A-T-O-R. Now, he reigned 33 years, and he was succeeded in the year 280 B.C. by Antiochus Soter. Now, watch this. You have Ptolemy Soter, and then you have Antiochus Soter. Now, later on, we're going to find there was a Ptolemy Epiphanes as well as an Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, don't get confused, because they're all kin. They're all Greeks. And they begin to swap their names back and forth. They intermarry, as you're going to see. And so when I mention Epiphanes, you begin to wonder, is it from Syria or Egypt? Now, here are the two directions involved. We have on one hand the north and one hand the south. The king of the north is going to be the kings of Syria, which take the name, first of all, of Antiochus. And then the kings of the south are going to be the ones from Egypt who take the name of Ptolemy. Now, the north and south here, very plainly, as you'll see in a few moments, have to do with Palestine, and the north was Syria, and the south was Egypt. Both of these were divisions of the Greek Empire, and these two sections begin to war against each other, and that's where they begin to trample underfoot the land of Palestine. Now, so many people want to read into this, something is not there. They try to read Russia in the north and Palestine in the south. Well, you hear that everywhere you go and everywhere you look, you'll find that in writings and all kind of teachings on the television. But it just doesn't for a moment indicate it. It's not the right time for it, and it just doesn't fit, as you'll see later on in our studies. Continuing on now, we're going to find that from the fifth verse forward, the he's and the hims are going to be a lot of confusion. Now, attention, of course, are these four divisions of Greece. It's not going to be on Greece proper. It's not going to be on any other area of the Greek Empire except Egypt in the south and Syria in the north. Because the others don't affect God's people, therefore he doesn't concern himself with them. They were there, they existed, but they really were not important for our study, and so he's not going to mention those. We're going to be talking continually about the kings of the north and the kings of the south. As we continue on, we read in verse 5-6, and in the end of years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south and the shall come to the king of the north and make an agreement. So the north and the south, through their kings and the daughter of one of those, are going to be joined in marriage. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand. You see, you have she and then he. Who in the world are you talking about? Nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. You have about, if I remember right, four or five he's here, and they're talking about different people. Now let's see if we can untangle that by going to secular history. Now God's not trying to confuse us, but if he gave us all these details, the book of Daniel would be about as long as the book of Revelation and Jeremiah, maybe. So he doesn't give us all the details, he gives us just enough to know when he gets to secular history what we're talking about. Well, the end of these years are going to be when these two join themselves together. Apparently this is a marriage that takes place. Now the king of the south is Egypt at this time, Egypt's Ptolemy Philadelphus. His daughter is Bernice. She marries Antiochus II Theos, who is now the king of Syria in the north. Now upon a condition, though, that Antiochus put away his wife, Laodice, and her children. The fact is, then, Bernice is going to marry the king, but she said, I'm not going to marry you until you get rid of your present wife and the children you have. And so he agrees to that. He gets rid of his wife, and he marries her. But then, after Antiochus marries her, and then he decides he doesn't want her, so he'll get his first wife again, so he again marries now Laodice. But when he marries her, she begins to think about them, and she says, no, wait a minute. He got rid of me to marry her. He got her to marry me. He still might not be satisfied. I'll get rid of him. So she does. She poisons the king, and consequently, his life is ended. So that gets rid of him. And of course, the treachery involved in his marrying and divorcing and remarriage and all that went on comes to a bitter end because he is dead. Now, Laodice places her son Callinicus upon the throne. And then, at this time, we see the procedures going farther. Verse 7. Out of the branch of her roots, this is, of course, they're talking about her son now, who's still alive, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Now, you've had the north and south united through marriage, but it didn't work out. And there were problems here. So, Bernice's brother now, Ptolemy the Third, comes to power in Egypt at this time, which is 247 B.C., and he invades the north now. And the king of the north, who had died before this king did, he fell off his horse in 226. He died 4 or 5 years earlier than the king of the south. So now verse 7 and 8 is summarized in verse 9. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So here the king of the south invades the north. He defeats the king up there. He goes back to the south, and there we find him just now. He returns again after to his kingdom in Egypt after he defeats the armies up in the north. Now verse 10 says, but his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. So, the king of the north now, who is one of the sons of the king who was murdered earlier by his mother, and by the mother apparently of this boy, he raises up against Ptolemy in the south. And his son, but he was poisoned by two of his own generals in a mutiny, is deposed. There was a problem over the wages, and they were not being paid, and so he's deposed. Now, Antiochus III, who was his son, and the only remaining son becomes a king. He retakes Seleucus and Syria and comes even to the border of Egypt in his mission in life. You see, we're just having back and forth again over and under armies fighting one against another. All these people who are kin to each other between the north and the south. Now, verse 11 tells us, the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. So the king of the south, which at this time is Ptolemy Philopater, who had succeeded his father, shall come forth and fight with Antiochus the Third, and he does. It mentions that he had here a great multitude. Now, history tells us that at this particular battle there were 62,000 foot soldiers. There were 6,000 men on horses. This is interesting. There were 102 fighting on elephants. That's a little odd to us today, but they fought on elephants back then. So he had indeed a very great force, of course. And this is called the Battle of Raphia. It took place in 217 B.C., and the north here was defeated by the south. We go on. Verse 12, when he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. So the south is going to be victorious, as they were, but he's not going to follow through in his victory, and therefore he's not going to be strengthened by it. He's going to defeat the army, but he's not going to be able to do anything beyond that point because he doesn't follow through. And so verse 12 brings an end to his effect. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. So after 14 years, Antiochus the third of the north, who's the one who's been fighting already, returned with a greater multitude and to the south. Now, his opponent had died in 204 B.C., and his five-year-old son, Ptolemy the fifth, Epiphanes, or this is the southern man who is illustrious now, was on the throne in Egypt, which was the south. Verse 14 tells us, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Now many shall stand up against the king of the south. Antiochus the third, the greatest he's called, was the king of the north. And also there were at this time robbers of thy people. It seems to be at this time that there are going to be some internal problems in the area of Palestine, perhaps an arising of what later on in the New Testament was called the tax collectors or the publicans. There was a great deal of problems internally going on where there were tax collectors appointed. They bought their offices and all kind of things took place now to develop a situation where the New Testament comes on the scene. The tax collector or the publican was a man who's not appreciated at all, even like we don't appreciate internal revenue people today. Now, it's possible that Isaiah might have seen this in chapter 30, but there's no direct indication that's what he's talking about. Now, some Jews would revolt, and they would join Ptolemy, and then they left Ptolemy, and they joined Antiochus III, so there was no real stability among them. At this time, however, there was from the south a general who arose. His name was Scopas, and he came and takes Palestine and Jerusalem and returns with great spoils from this area. In Jerusalem today, there is a mountain or a great hill called Mount Scopus. And there is up on top of that great hill a hotel called Hotel Scopus, if I remember correctly. Now, remember, I had been there for quite some time. I had not had a Coca-Cola in a long time. Now, the man who runs that hotel today was a friend of mine and friend of a friend of mine. And he was an Arab, but he knew Americans like Coca-Colas. And so he went down and said, would you like to have a Coke? And, of course, he gave us a real old big cold Coca-Cola, the first I'd had in about 3 weeks, and it sure did taste good. But you can look out over the top of that hotel, Mount Scopus, and see all of Jerusalem lying below you there. And it's named for this same general, and, of course, they told me about this general when I was over there, who had conquered them back at the time of this war. And, of course, they know that it was an Egyptian general who did it. Verse 15 and 16 continues on. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount, take the most fenced cities and the arms of the south, and shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So Antiochus the third of the north now again comes with armies. He has great victory against the south, but notice now verse 16. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now we have Antiochus the third of the north. He comes down to the glorious land, which of course is Israel. He brought back those who were dispersed. He reestablished them in the land. He freed the priests and the Levites from the tributes that they were having to pay. Verse 17 tells us, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him. There again, you have a hymn that doesn't mean a thing to you just now as far as subjects are concerned. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. You know, you've heard about young kids taking sides when they choose. Well, this is where it comes from. It comes from the statement of the Bible. Well, what happens now is that he, who is Antiochus III, the great of the north, shall give him the daughter of women. So he proposed to give his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to Ptolemy the Fifth of Egypt, and he proceeded to do that. This is in 193 B.C. So we have the daughter of the Syrian king, Cleopatra. She marries now the king in Egypt, who is named Ptolemy the Fifth. Now, the king of the north, who was the father of Cleopatra, intended to use her and through the influence he would have through her to gain control and power over the king of the south. And that's what he wanted, and that's the reason he married her off to him, and that's the reason that this all was undertaken, but it didn't work. Because when Cleopatra went down there and married Ptolemy, she liked him. And she wouldn't work with her father and listen to her father, and so she worked against her father, and she was in agreement with her husband now, who was the king of the south. But she shall not, as it says here, stand on his side, neither be for him. I'm talking here about her father. And so that conniving trick didn't work. But verse 18 says, after this he shall turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but the prince of his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. That his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Alexander the Third, now the great of the north, turns his, Antiochus the Third, the great of the north, turns his attention to the sea. He has a navy of 100 large vessels and 200 small vessels, and he subdues many of the maritime provinces that were at that time available to him in the Mediterranean Sea. And he touched the islands of Rhodes, of Samos, of Euboea, of Salophon, and others that were in the area and conquered them. Very rarely read of sea battles, but here we have the conquest of those. He was defeated by a Roman at the Straits of Thermopylae, and that which was in Greece, and he was required to pay tribute, and his battle stopped. He was defeated. He was required to pay tribute. And he went on back home, knowing now that instead of receiving tribute from those he intended to defeat, he now has been defeated, and he was supposed to pay them tribute. But verse 19 tells us that the tables are turned. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, toward his home, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So he's going to die. Antiochus the Great, now the north, returns to his home, to his fort. But upon attempting to raise funds to pay the tribute that he's due to the Greeks, then apparently he died, was slain before this could be done, and so he stumbled and fell and could not succeed in what he was supposed to do. Now verse 20 tells us, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. Now, Seleucus Philopator of the north succeeds his father. It was his attempt to raise the necessary funds to pay off the tribute he was supposed to pay, his father was supposed to pay, and he intended to do that by going to Jerusalem and taking the treasury from the temple there. But apparently he was killed and attempted to do so, and he never did succeed in that, so he didn't actually raise those funds either, as it shows here. Verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person, in whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So now, Antiochus Epiphanes, the one we've been talking about early in chapter 8, and the one we're going to talk about again in chapter 12, he all of a sudden rises on the scene. So really, if you can look at what we've been talking about, I know we've been confusing, and I know it's something that we've been talking about relatively fast. It would take you weeks to ever unveil all these kind of things and dig into the history of them. The fact is, what we've been doing is leading up to the time where Epiphanes comes on the scene. And when we read of him, we're going to be able to bring our thoughts to a close before very long. He now ascends to the kingship of the land. He wins his position by flattery because we want to find out he's cruel and ruthless and mean, and everything we could say about him wouldn't be too much. He pays tribute to the Romans. And possibly he's mentioned here without principle of any kind, and the word vile person, I think, denotes that. We continue on now, and verse 22, with the arms of a flood shall they be overthrown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now here we're going to find he's going to set up and tear down certain priests. Now these priests, who were the descendants of true and proper priests, begin now to be bought and sold. So Antiochus Epiphanes
has no scruples at all. He has no honesty at all whatsoever. And he bribes and he buys and he tears down. And anything to his advantage, he does it. So he's taking advantage of the priest of God, or who should have been the priest of God. And he corrupts them every way. So he really is just turning things inside out for evil and for sin. So this wicked and corrupt tyrant began his reign. And he is greatly against the king of Egypt in the south. And notice now the one we're talking about is from the north. And he begins now to have a great deal of effect toward Egypt. We continue on and read quite a bit before we talk again about this. Verse 23. After the lead made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the provinces. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, the spoil, the riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. For they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed on the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, the king of the north and the king of the south. And they shall speak lies at one table. Now there was a time during this conflict that they did come to a conference table, and they begin to make plans for peace and harmony, but neither one of them kept the word. And there were lies spoken there, and they still cannot be at peace. But it shall not prosper, it says, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land with great riches. His heart shall be against the holy covenant. He shall do exploits and return to his own land. Verse 29. At the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, we've had a conflict going on between the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, the latest conflict we have is between Epiphanes in the north and the king of the south. And Epiphanes, the one we've been talking about, is a very ruthless and vile and mean person, as we well see. But he finally comes for the last time to Egypt. He takes away spoils. He's been doing that over and over again. Seems he's been very victorious time and time again. But now he goes back to Egypt again. And is to take spoils, but verse 30 tells us, for the ships of Shittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return. And notice, he comes to Egypt, but as he approaches Egypt this time, there's some ships on the scene he hadn't seen before. There's some ships there on the sea that all of a sudden are an obstacle to him. And so he faces a new threat, somebody he hasn't seen before, somebody that's going to arise on the scene and take over everything. Now, these are the emissaries from Rome. And so they're on the scene in 171, and he meets them face to face. He decides to go out and talk with them and decide what's to be done. He doesn't have an army that can all defeat them. They have orders from the Senate in Rome. No doubt he's been hearing about that rising power. But now they come, they meet him, they have orders from Rome that he's to turn tail and go back home. He doesn't like that a little bit. Now watch this again. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So when he met these people on the shore and they told him to go back home, he didn't like it at all. He told them that he would go and talk to his men and consider the matter. That didn't set well at all with those who had the authority from Rome, so one of them stepped forward with his staff and he drew a circle in the sand around Epiphanes. He said, "You'll give us your answer before you step out of this circle." He wasn't about to take on Rome. He made his answer right then. He turned tail, he went back toward home and didn't engage the Romans. That's 171. Remember we talked about that last night? Now we're ready to go. So Epiphanes now is defeated, at least as far as his ambition is concerned and his desires to again invade Egypt and do harm and danger down there. So he turns and he goes back home, but as verse 30 tells us, on the way back home, he decides that what he'll do is just sack Jerusalem and just do it damage, all kind of damage. Now we're going to talk about that in chapter 12, but the fact is, here's where he first robbed the temple. He goes back toward Syria. He goes by way of Jerusalem. He sacks Jerusalem. He robs the temple. And that's where, as you remember last night, he offers a sow as a sacrifice on the altar of God. So there he first desecrates the altar by offering this sow and by robbing the events, the things in the temple. He shall have indignation against the covenant, holy covenant. He shall, and so shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. So there's going to be some sort of collusion between him and those around Jerusalem who will be wicked and evil and not serve God, and they're going to open the doors to him later on as he begins to invade once more. We continue on now, and notice that verse 31 says, arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now remember this, because in chapter 12 he's going to bring it back again. You see, what Daniel does, because God told him to, is tell us something, and then he goes more in detail, and then he comes back and repeats and goes more detail again. He doesn't want us to be confused about these matters. Now, so many people take Daniel here, and they project it not only from there, but way off into the future. Adam Clark, very good commentator, projects this up to the year 1966. It doesn't fit, but he made an awfully good try to do that, did a world of research, and his reasoning is sensible. But the fact is, so many people who look at these and try to find the future don't realize the fact that we're talking primarily about the people in Daniel's day, who will soon follow and bring us to a fitting place to understand the arise and the coming on of the Romans. That's what Daniel's trying to tell us. There's going to be Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. So Daniel brings us up to Rome, and he leaves us there. And then, of course, when Matthew comes on the scene, Rome is in power, as we know the Bible story. Now we take a look at the nature of this man we've been talking about, beginning with verse 31. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the day of sacrifice, and shall take and place the abomination that maketh desolate. Whatever that is, we're going to talk about later. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Now there are some he's going to be able to convince. There are some he's going to be able through flattery to convince to follow him and work with him. But others are going to stand up, and they'll oppose him. Now, we talked about them last night, and I think I'll read to you something about that tonight. But the fact is, they're going to be marvelous people who stand for truth. They'll be killed, they'll be slaughtered, all kind of things will be done against them, but they'll stand. They'll flee to the mountains, but you read of them, of course, in secular history as the Maccabees. By the way, I spelled this wrong. If anybody's copying that, that's two E's there instead of two B's. But anyway, Maccabees, all the people we're talking about, it was a family of men. And the older man, Mattathias, was the old father. Later on, they all began to be called Maccabees, or the Hammer of God. And this is the term of these people that we're reading about here. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall with the sword of the flame by captivity and by fall many days. Now, when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Continuing on. Some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Daniel is told here that these things are going to come to an end, but it won't be yet. There's a while before this is going to occur, so wait. The king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, shall prosper till the indignation be completed. Now, his atrocities are going to come to an end. They'll be completed, and they will come to a fitting end, and you'll find tonight that he's going to be bitterly destroyed in an awful way. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of the fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. This is the illustrious one. This is Epiphanes. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and the God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones, with pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. So here we find Rome coming on the scene now, predicting that it's going to come on the scene. And he, of course, is going to be in a very utter disaster, as we later on going to define. But as these ships come, look at verse 41. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. Now, as Rome comes in, they're going to take the glorious land too. But notice the land that they are going to take and the lands that will be left where they won't take them. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, in secular history, you'll read where Rome took over the Middle East, but there are some areas they did not conquer. And one of those, if you want to read about it, is in the book of Obadiah in the Old Testament. That one chapter book tells you about that nation that escaped. In fact, we did not know it even existed until 1812. In 1812, it was found again, but of course God mentions it right here, the nation of Edom. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. That's where they meet Epiphanes. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Liberians and the Ethiopians shall be at his step. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Now thoughts turn back again to Epiphanes. Tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. He has trouble back home in the east. He has the Romans coming from the north. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to take away many. He goes back on Jerusalem now. And as he goes toward Jerusalem to utterly destroy it, in his fury and rage, because now Jerusalem has taken over, it's been taken over again by the Maccabees, something awful happens to him. And the last verse tells about it. He shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas of the glorious holy mountain. He's going to establish a temple in Jerusalem. And this temple is going to be dedicated to Zeus. He's going to offer swine sacrifices on it and compel the people to do the same thing. But watch what happens. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Doesn't make much sense just reading those words, I know. But as we read secular history, we're going to find that some very, very interesting things take place about this man and the events of which we've been reading. So we turn now rapidly, I hope, to chapter 12. At that time shall Michael stand up. So we see that God's going to intervene here. The great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. You see, God has a book of life. And that book of life is one that he mentions in the Old Testament, I know of, twice, once here. We find it also mentioned in the New Testament. This simply denotes those who are pleasing to God. God has a knowledge of who they are. They're not going to escape his sight. Of course, they wouldn't want to. But the fact is, he knows every single one who tries to serve him, no matter what their problem is, no matter how difficult they are, the difficult time they're having, no matter how far they go or what they're involved with, God knows where they are. Don't forget that fact. You remember, he knew Samson had his eyes put out. He was slaving down as a captor of the Philistines. God didn't forget him. His hair grew longer and longer and longer and longer, unbeknown to the Philistines. When it got long enough, God used him in his death to destroy more Philistines than ever destroyed in his life. Now, God doesn't forget where we are. And don't you ever forget that God knows and sees and understands the plight you're in. He says, now, my people are having a very, very bad plight, but I won't forget them. I'm going to remember them. He says, everyone that's found written in the book. And then verse 2 is a very interesting verse. And many of them which sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Resurrected? Are we talking about the end of the world? You see, that's what so many people see in prophecy. They take a word or a thought, and all of a sudden they say, oh, that's talking about the end of time, because we've already been talking about the end. And so they apply this to the end of the world. So now verse 2 is talking about the end of time. No, not at all. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now tomorrow night, I plan to go, Lord willing, into great detail about symbols and what symbols are and how they're used and how to understand those. That'll be tomorrow night. But tonight, suffice it to say, the Lord speaks in symbols, speaks in picturesque language, speaks in figurative language many, many times in the Bible, throughout the Bible. Now, one of those is in Ezekiel chapter 37. It's a very interesting book, very interesting chapter. In chapter 7, you find that there is a valley just full of dead bones, dried bones. There's no flesh, there's no sinew, there's no muscle, there's nothing in there except plain old dried bones. All of a sudden, flesh begins to come back, and they come back to life. They stand up once more. Now, of course, you never have seen that happen, and God never saw that happen. It's simply a picturesque way of showing that Israel, who has been slaughtered, who have been an outcast people, who have been a captured people for 70 years, because they disobeyed me, I'm going to allow to come back to life again. So they came back out of that captivity and once again lived in the land of Israel, in the promised land. God is merely that picture in the fact that Israel has symbolically died, I'm going to bring them back to life again. That's what Ezekiel 37 means. Now, he was doing the same thing. He's going to talk about those who've been trampled underfoot. He's going to talk about those who have been abused and harmed and overrun and killed and slaughtered by Epiphanes, by the forces of Greece. But God's going to take vengeance on for them, against him. And those who have been faithful and dedicated and have been strong, they're going to come back to life again and once more inherit the land and the temple and be my people. And they did. And they stayed there from this time, which was 165 B.C., until Christ comes on the scene, dies on the cross, and then for 40 more years they stay there, then they're scattered once more throughout the entire world, as Luke 21 tells us they would be. The fact is, then, he's talking here about a figurative resurrection. These people in Jerusalem who've been harmed, they have had their houses burned, they have had their people slayed before their eyes, they have had to run to the hills, they're going to come back to life again. So there's a resurrection here of those who are righteous. But then he says there's some who's going to be resurrected to shame and everlasting life. So some have been wicked and evil and harmed, and they're not going to receive this with joy. So Israel, once more, the Jews, once more, are going to come back in the limelight. God's going to bless them because, and notice this, they had to be there on the scene a little over a century later for Christ to come to his people. You see, God's not going to let them be destroyed. They've almost been destroyed. They've been captured time and time again. There's a handful of them left. But God told us in the time of Genesis that Israel was to be the vehicle through which the Messiah would come. So he's going to preserve his people and let them stay there. They're going to be alive and alert people when Christ comes. Now, Rome comes on the scene. And in 64 B.C., they go into Jerusalem. They take Jerusalem. They remodel the temple. And it's there intact for Christ when he comes on the scene as a babe in 4 B.C. in Bethlehem. So you see, all in the world God's doing is preparing now for the setting of his son when he comes. He's telling us the people involved, the situations involved, they've had all kinds of difficulty, but he's going to put them back again to be receivers of Christ when he comes. Now, verse 3. And they said that be wise, there's some who are not, and they're going to not enjoy this because they have transgressed the will of God, and they're going to be harmed, and they're going to receive the blame. But they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. So he's trying to speak in very favorable terms of those now who are faithful and dedicated and strong and endure, even though it's been hard. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the word and seal the book even to the time of the end. You see, this is ahead of Daniel's day. Daniel couldn't see it completely. You know, the old statement is, I'd give my right arm if I could do that. I'm sure Daniel would have given his right arm if he could have seen these things. They're so beautiful and so lovely. He didn't really understand all those, but God says, you close up the book. I'll tell you what I want you to know. But it's going to go just a little bit farther, and it's going to end. Many shall run to and fro. Knowledge shall be increased. No doubt this is where many people say that in the end of time, knowledge is going to be increased. It's not talking about the end of time. But there will be those who understand that when through history we can look back now and see those things, and of course those who experience these things could see that because Christ read plainly tells us about Daniel himself as do others. Now verse 5 says, then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood two other angels. The one on this side of the bank and the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall be to the end of these wonders? Now the man clothed in linen is probably Gabriel. Well, I'm going to say probably, because as I read chapter 9:21, chapter 10, verse 5, and verse 13 and verse 21, it seems to indicate that Gabriel is this man who's clothed in linen. But at any rate, we find that he is told to let Daniel know what it's all about. How long shall it be to the end of these days? And I heard the man clothed in linen which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever. So, of course, this angel is appealing to God as the source of this knowledge and giving God praise and honor and glory. He says, it shall be for a time and times and a half. Now, time, times and a half, as we had discovered earlier. I won't go into that tonight because we will later on again. We did that a time or two earlier. Time, times and half time simply means that there's going to be a year for time, and there's going to be 2 years for times, or plural of time, and a half year for a half. That would be, since it's 360 days and a symbolic year, there would be 360 days, 720 days, and 180 days, which would be 1,260 days. So this apparently is what we're talking about, and as you can see on the map, we have 1,260 days mentioned in verse 6. Now, we had also noticed in chapter 8, verse 14, there was to be a period of time of 2,300 days. Now, last night we discussed the fact that that started in 171, at which time Epiphanes first invaded and robbed the temple and offered the style. We read that last night. And then we showed that from the Lord's comments in chapter 8, that this was to be a duration of time until the temple was cleansed. So if we have discussed this properly, the 2,300 days are to be the extension of time from when the sacrifice was taken away, when it was desecrated, and when the temple was robbed and the style was offered. But notice, it didn't say there that there was something set up that later on we're going to find. We don't find anything set up here. Remember that term. But we do find the desecration of the temple. And that was to be for 2,300 years. Now, we find that in 168, there was something occurring that would go on for 1,260 days. Let's see what we can find about that as we turn to some other places that might be enlightening to us. He says, how long shall this be? He says, 1,000, or time, time, half time. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all of these things shall be finished. So he's going to scatter the holy people, but it does not say he's going to erect something in the place where God's worship and service had been done. He shall accomplish the scattering of these. He's speaking about Antiochus Epiphanes and his evil. Now we're going down a little farther, and I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go thy way, Daniel. For the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end of what we're talking about, not the end of time. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall be wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Don't let anybody tell you you can't understand Daniel or Revelation or Ezekiel, because God did not for a moment pretend to write something they couldn't be understood. He wasn't trying to tantalize us. He wrote these things for us to know and to see, but also to be revealed when the time came for them to be, and to be revealed for the, by those, or to those who would be wise. It doesn't take a mastermind. It takes someone who's honest and dedicated to understand these things. And that's what he's telling us. If we want to know, we can know about what these things are. Now, verse 11, he begins now to unfold again the understanding of these things. Now, there's a key in verse 11 to dating the things we're talking about, and he gives us that key. The first part of that says, from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away. So now he starts our figure of understanding this next count of time, from when the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up. So you see over here we had the temple desecrated and it was robbed, but now we have something that was set up, that was dedicated in the temple now, an altar, and the temple itself was dedicated to Zeus. So it was not set up here, so that's not the time to look at. Here's the time to look at for, as you notice in the last part of that verse, 1,290 days. So verse 11 says that when this abomination is set up, which of course would be abominable to take the altar of God and offer pigs on it, and to offer the entire temple now dedicated not to God Almighty, to Jehovah, but to Zeus. He says that will be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that watcheth and cometh to the 1,335 days. So we have 2,300 days, 1,260 days, 1,290 days, 1,335 days. All four of those mentioned. But go thy way to the end, for they shall rest and stand in their lot at the end of thy days. Let's go now to some things that we need to read. And in reading these, I think we'll be able to make ourselves a little bit more knowledgeable because of what secular history now tells us happened. We wouldn't possibly know these things, couldn't possibly know them, unless we look in secular history about the matters. I want to turn, first of all, to the book of Maccabees. Maccabees is a historian, a book of history, which was written about the events we're talking of. Now, some of your Bibles, probably not many of you, may have this in the middle of your Bibles between Malachi and Matthew. If you don't have it there, and most of the modern King James versions or some of the other modern versions don't have it there, the Catholic version does, and some of the older King James will. And this is a collection of books which don't for a moment believe, because these were written by men. They're not inspired. There's not one single reference anywhere in the entire Bible to any of these. So don't think these are inspired. They're not. But the books of Maccabees are very, very good history, like Josephus and some others, Herodotus and different ones. They're excellent historians, even though they're not inspired. And so the things they write help us tie in the things that have been predicted because they're writing about what took place where Daniel was predicting these things. Now in the book of 2 Maccabees, chapter 6, and beginning in this chapter with verse 1 and reading through verse 2, we're going to find some things that took place about this time. You remember now that we have Epiphanes, who's come into Jerusalem. He sacked it, and now he's gone on. And now he comes back again and sets up the temple Zeus, as we have mentioned earlier. And this is about that situation. Now, the Maccabees are on the scene, and they've been fighting against him. And they're in the mountains, and they're living a very sad life, a difficult life, but they're fighting. Over and over and over again, little by little, they're killed out. But they're fighting the oppressors now, and will do so until Rome comes on the scene. But Judas, also called Maccabeus, was, with about nine others, escaped into the desert, where he and his companions lived in the mountains, fending for themselves like the wild animals. They remained there, living on what vegetation they found, so as to have no share in the pollution. They would not serve the god of Antiochus. Now, we read on down to the second verse of chapter 6. That was the last verse, chapter 5. Shortly thereafterward, King Antiochus sent an elderly Athenian to force the Jews to abandon their ancestral customs and no longer regulate their lives according to the laws of God. He was also commissioned to pollute the temple at Jerusalem and dedicate it to Olympian Zeus and to dedicate the sanctuary on Mount Gerizim to Zeus, god of hospitality, from the practice of the local inhabitants. This plainly tells us there that what he does now is to establish in the most holy place a false altar, and also now a false god is observed there. So here he proved the temple, but here he sets up that which was an abomination. So we have now set up this false idol and image and dedication to a false god with a temple of God. I think this is then where we see the year 168 come to the scene, where we have the beginning of the 1,260 years. Now, as we continue on, we'll notice that Jerusalem was taken by the Maccabees. We turn to chapter 10 of 2 Maccabees and read the first two verses. Now, let's see, probably a little bit more of this chapter. Maccabeus, with his men, led by the Lord, recovered the temple and city of Jerusalem. He demolished the altars erected by the heathen in the public square, and their sacred precincts as well. When they had purified the sanctuary, they constructed another altar. Then, striking fire and flints, they offered a sacrifice for the first time for 2 whole years. He goes on down and tells us now what they did to restore again and cleanse the temple. Now, this is in Maccabees chapter 10, which is quite a bit ahead of our story. But the fact is, I want you to see we're going toward a time at which the temple is cleansed and purified. They begin to erect a new altar with not hewn stones, but with stones that gathered, as the old law would have required. So here, Jerusalem is again taken by the Maccabees. Now, as the Maccabees come in, and they take Jerusalem, and they begin to clean up the place and make it habitable like it should have been and like God wanted it to be. In the meantime, Antiochus had been in battle with some other people, and he'd been beat. He had not been successful, but he heard that the Jews had come back into Jerusalem now. And so, in retaliation, he comes back toward Jerusalem. He wants to take it, get tribute from them, and that's where he's going now. That's what he's about to do. Now, we read of this in 2 Maccabees, chapter 9, beginning with verse 4 of this chapter. It speaks of the Jews paying tribute for the injury inflicted by those who had put him to flight, and so he ordered his charioteer to drive without stopping until his journey was finished. This is Antiochus now. But as he comes on back toward Jerusalem from the defeat in Persia where he was, as he comes on back to make another invasion to Jerusalem and to do all he can to harm the people even still more, watch what happens to him. But as you do, remember now, the last verse, next to the last verse of chapter right before, it says that he's going to come to a bitter end. Now also, we find that there was not going to be any that could help him. You remember chapter 8, verse 15 says, he'll be broken without hand. Now, he's not going to be defeated in the war. He's not going to be killed or harmed by one of his men. But something's going to happen to him that's without human hands being involved. And he's going to come to an end without anyone to help. Let's see what that verse actually said. Verse 45. And he shall plant the tabernacle of the palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, which he did, palace of Zeus. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now that's where we are. And this is what we're going to read as to what happened to him. But riding with him was a divine judgment. For in his arrogance he said, when I reach Jerusalem, I will make it a common graveyard for the Jews. But the all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him a fatal and invisible blow. As soon as he had said these words, he was seized with incurable pain in his bowels and with sharp internal torments, a punishment entirely fitting for one who had inflicted many unheard-of torments on the bowels of others. Still he did not in the least abate his insolence. More arrogant than ever, he breathed fiery threats against the Jews. After he'd given orders to speed up the journey, it happened that he fell out of his chariot as it hurled along, and so violent was his fall that every joint in his body was dislocated. He, who in his pretension to be more than man, had just been thinking that he could command the waves of the sea and the high mountains on the scales, was brought to the ground and had to be carried in a litter, thus making God's power manifest to all. Now this is interesting. And what we're reading was written many, many centuries ago, after these things occurred, as a record of what took place. Now, Josephus writes about these same things. But Maccabees, I think, gives it much, much clearer. Now listen to the next sentence or two, if you have stomach to. Worms swarmed even from the eyes of this godless man, and while he was still alive and in agony, his flesh rotted off, and the whole army was disgusted by the stench of his decay. It was so unbearably offensive that nobody could escort the man who only a short time before had seemed to touch the stars in the sky. And so history, and this is just one reading, history tells you this man died an awful death, and some books I read even said that he stunk so bad nobody could be in the room with him. Now that's the way this man died. And so Daniel told us in the 45th verse of chapter 11. I think then we find that what has happened is that this man comes to a very, very bitter end because of his affliction of God's people. And the Bible tells us there was to be a time of 1,290 days, which apparently have to do with this man coming to an end. Notice we have 1,260 days. Then we have 30 more days at which he hears about the Jews entering into Jerusalem, conquering Jerusalem again. 30 days later, he tries to get over there and take advantage of their presence and kill them and slaughter them and do harm to them again. But in those 30 days, he dies. But 45 days later, 1,035 days, something else happens. And this is very interesting, I think. Our next reading, we go to, let's see. Anyway, the temple was cleansed, and there were proper sacrifices restored, and this continued under the time of A.D. 70. It's interesting to note, and I think I should tell you this for the sake of being honest, that we're talking about 1,260 days, 1,290 days, 1,335 days, but historians don't agree as to how these things occurred, and some historians even conflict themselves. I'm going to tell you where it is so you can be aware of this fact. In 2 Maccabees chapter 10, verse 3, he says this occurred in 2 years. In Josephus, in the wars part of his book, in the 7th paragraph, he says this was 3 years and 3 months. And then Josephus in another place, in book 12, in chapter 7, and paragraph 6, as I remember, he says it was 3 years. So we have these three authors, one telling us it was 2 years, one saying it was 3 years, and again he says it was 3 years and 3 months. Now I wasn't there. Nobody else was even today. So all we have to take the word of men who lived about that time. So frankly, I can't tell you the exactness of this, because even the early authors don't agree. Now some of the brethren here wondered why today I spent all day long trying to look these things up. I was trying my dead devil best to get these ancient historians to agree, and they didn't. And so this is as close as I can come. But it does seem to fit very, very well to what we're talking about. In the book of Josephus, I want to read to you a comment made about it that might help us to be a little bit more informative about what we're speaking of. Book 12, chapter 8, and the 6th paragraph. The last sentence of it says, "And this desolation came to pass according to the prophecy of Daniel, which was given 408 years before, for he declared that the Macedonians would dissolve that worship for some time." So Josephus tells us now that what we're talking about, and he spoke about these events right here and right here. He said these are those things which God spoke about through Daniel. Now as we continue on over to the time of the temple being cleansed, we come to the end of the 1,335 days. We notice now that there was the cleansing of the temple. They went in and cleaned up the inside of it. They redid everything that had to be done over again. They took the old altar which had been desecrated. They completely did it away, and they built a new one there. And as everything was cleaned and made an arrangement like it should, and everything got exactly like it ought to be again, then once more they offered a sacrifice to God in the proper place, in the proper way, for the proper people, as God intended for them to do that. Now, it was called, and it is called today, Hanukkah. Hanukkah occurs on December the 25th or near December the 25th of each year. I've been to a Hanukkah service, and it's very impressive, by the way, and someday I'll tell you about the details if you want to hear about them. It's very interesting. But nonetheless, Hanukkah is what we're talking about in our modern Jewish terminology. But back in John 10:22, Christ called it the Feast of the Dedication. So it was something that carried on from that time forward, and that was to commemorate the cleansing of the temple and the doing away of Antioch Epiphanes and his harm and danger, and putting the people of God in order for this to continue as God intended for it to on the time of the coming of His Son. Now let me read to you, if I can find it, one more thing I think you need to know, and then we'll try to bring our thoughts to an end. This is in the section of Josephus called The Wars. It's in book 1, chapter 1 and paragraph 4. Now Judas, supposing that Antiochus would not lie still, gathered an army out of his own countrymen and was the first that made a league of friendship with the Romans and drove Epiphanes out of the country when he had made a second expedition into it. Now, what you see I've talked about tonight, he's going to summarize in one paragraph. And that's the reason I'm reading this. He's summarizing the whole thing. And this by giving him a great defeat there. And when he was warned by this great success, he made an assault upon the garrison that was in the city, for it had not been cut off hitherto. So he ejected them out of the upper city and drove the soldiers into the lower, which part of the city was called the citadel. And these are where the Greeks under Antiochus were when Maccabees came back in and took the city again. The Greeks were there in a small area, and they could not defeat the Jews because they were surrounded. And that's what he's saying. He then got the temple under his power and cleansed the whole place and walled it round about and made new vessels for sacred ministrations and brought them into the temple because the former vessels had been profaned. He also built another altar and began to offer the sacrifices. And when the city had already received its sacred constitution again, Antiochus died, whose son Antiochus succeeded him in the kingdom and in his hatred to the Jews also. And thus we, I think, can see the completion of the book of Daniel and what it was all about, and now prepared to go from that point forward to the time of Christ and now his revelation to us in the book called Revelation. We've talked a long time tonight. We have the last three nights. Lord willing, tomorrow night we won't talk this long. It'll be a lot shorter, and so I want to advise you ahead of time not to worry about the length. But you've been so patient, and I appreciate that. I regret talking so long. I think you can see why I needed a month. But at any rate, appreciate the 2 weeks. Appreciate so much your concern in coming. Let's stand now as we sing this final song of praise. Do continue. Our miracles never cease. Well, to apply that another way, we're certainly glad to know the Lord's word still is effective and works, and the interest and concern shown Saturday by these two brethren who went over. And other instances such as that we have seen is certainly encouraging, and for that we're all grateful, I'm sure, and thankful. Good to see each of you tonight and to have you here in our studies, and we trust that our coming together might be profitable spiritually to all of us. We're in the book of Daniel, and in that book there are some things that we have not touched on yet, and before we conclude, I suppose we should bring these matters out because they are important. And if we do not touch on them now, you will probably have an occasion someday to have them brought up to you. And so I think we better touch on those at this time. For we're going to go into part of that tonight in our study, and then some of it we've already covered without going into detail about it. I'm speaking about the abominations of Daniel. Now, this is mentioned by Christ, and it's also mentioned here in Daniel several times. And it would be well for us to make a note of the fact that the abominations of Daniel are not one, but there are two. Now, it's mentioned four times. But as it's mentioned, we notice that they have different applications, so that there's not one abomination, there's two spoken of, and we must know the setting of those to understand what he's talking about and when he's talking about it. Now, the first one of these is in Daniel 8, verse 13. He speaks of the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. Now, we're going to talk about that tonight, even though in chapter 12. But we're going to talk about that because it has to do with the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So the transgression of desolation has to do, as he says here, with the sanctuary and the host. Now, the next time is in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. And here it says, they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. So something's going to be placed somewhere. This again is the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and it refers to something which at this time has already long since passed, as well as all these have, of course, and we're going to talk about that again tonight too. However, there's another one mentioned in chapter 12, verse 11, and here it says, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up,
So something is to be taken away and something placed in its stead. There shall be 1,290 days. This is Daniel 12:11, and talks again about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So three times these are talked about Antiochus and the events we're talking about tonight. But the other one is one which was at that time down quite a ways in the future. It happened in 70 A.D. It's found in Daniel chapter 9, verses 26 and 27. Here it says, until the end of the war, desolations are determined, and for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. Now that is referred to by Jesus in Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16, when he says, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Here he's talking about something that happened a long time after the first three mentions of the abomination of desolation. Now the first three of those we have referred to, they happened in the time span we're going to talk about tonight. But the fourth of these, mentioned in Daniel 9, was to take place in 70 A.D., and of course, all these now have already taken place. So keep that in mind, because, like I said, if we don't go into a lot of detail tonight, someday perhaps you may find, nonetheless, an opportunity to look into these matters, because there are some misunderstandings in the world around us about this very matter. Our thoughts tonight are to begin with chapter 10 of the book of Daniel, and we continue on through chapter 10 through the entirety of the book tonight, chapter 12, and should find some very interesting and very long and involved readings in these verses. Chapter 10 tells us we're talking about the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. This should be about the year 536 B.C., if we have our calculation correctly. And verse 14 says, I am now come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. So Daniel is told that something is going to occur many days ahead, and I'm come to tell you about it. Now, verse 11, we have an introduction. We have an instruction from Gabriel to Daniel. He tells us, in effect, in verse 20, that Persia is to be followed by Greece. So as we looked on the right-hand board last night, and it's been erased, of course, I erased it myself last night, we had four kingdoms which were to arise on the earthly scene. There was Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. In the days of the Roman Caesars, there was to be a stone symbolically cut out of the mountain without hands. It was to touch the image on the feet, which was Rome, and to break the image into pieces, but it was to spread throughout the entire world and to stand forever. And that, of course, is the Lord's church. Now, in order to continue the same thought we see in chapter 2, we've seen in the following chapters a number of things that repeat themselves. Chapter 7, for an example, gave us the same picture again, but expanded it even beyond what the second chapter did. Chapter 8 talks to us again about the same picture and does not go quite as far as chapter 7, but gives more detail than chapter 2 did. Now, as we continue on down, chapter 9 tells us about the coming of Jesus Christ and ties that in with chapter 7, because chapter 7 also predicted that. Now, tonight, chapter 11 and 12, particularly chapter 11, is going to, in effect, pick up chapter 8 again and go much, much more in detail about chapter 8, give you a much more complete picture of it, and then give a fitting conclusion to the effects of what he's been talking about. So we're really going to find ourselves repeating what we have already talked about, but in more detail, so we can be emphatically sure of what we're talking about. And then, of course, tomorrow night, we'll proceed to the book of Revelation. If you will read chapter 1, you probably need to read chapters 2 and 3 also. I don't know how far we get in chapter 1, but probably all the way through it. So I'd like for you, if you would, to read chapters 2 and 3. Now, in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 16 and Daniel chapter 9 verse 21, we refer to Gabriel. And then in chapter 10, 13 and Daniel 10 verse 21, again, there's a reference probably to Gabriel. He does not tell us for certain who it is. The name's not mentioned, but he refers to some things that allows us very clearly to tie in with Gabriel, who was just mentioned. And then chapter 10 and verse 13, and chapter 10, verse 21, and chapter 12, verse 1, refer to Michael. So we have two angels under consideration in chapter 10. Now, Michael, mentioned in chapter 13, chapter 10, verse 13, is the only angel ever mentioned in the Bible as being an archangel, the only one. That might seem to be a little unusual, but that's the way it's written. However, we do find that, and that was in Jude, verse 9, we do find that he's spoken of in Revelation 12, verse 7, as being Michael and his angels. Now, the fact that it shows his as a pronoun referring to himself, but also perhaps showing possession, since the next word shows something it refers to, might well let us illustrate that Michael here is spoken of as a chief angel or an archangel. And partly that is true because in the same reference, we find that he's spoken of as one of the chief angels. But if he's mentioned as merely one of chief angels, we wonder then if the others were not archangels too, but just were not referred to that way. Don't mean to confuse you. But the fact is, he's the only one mentioned as an archangel, but he's spoken of as one of the chief angels. So if there were chief angels, likely we had more than one archangel, but he's the only one actually referred to by that term. Now the context of Daniel 10, verse 13, and also 21 and 12, 20, and 12, verse 1, indicates a conflict of some kind. Let me repeat that. The context of Daniel 10, verse 13, and verse 21, as well as 12 and verse 1, indicate there might have been some kind of a conflict going on. And we'll see what that has to say. Verse 10 tells us, "And behold, an hand touched me, which set to me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hand." So someone is touching, or something is touching Daniel. Verse 13 says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me." Now, the one consideration is speaking. This, of course, was no doubt Gabriel. And for 1 and 20 days, "But lo, Michael, one of these chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the king of Persia." So we have a conflict of some kind going on in which Gabriel is involved, and he says, "Michael, one of the chief angels, came to help me." So we have Michael and Gabriel working together, and for some reason they were involved in some type of a conflict. He mentions the prince of the kingdom of Persia. So there was some kind of conflict going on that we're not told of. So, of course, I don't have the right or the insight to speculate as to what it was, except for the fact that something was going on that Gabriel and Daniel needed to be involved with together. And it seems to me, if I may suggest this, that it may well have been, since they were dealing with Persia, and since they're going to say in the very last part of verse 13, "And I remained there with the kings of Persia," he goes ahead and tells us here that Grecia is going to take over, that it may well have to do with the fall, downfall of Persia and the coming in of Greece. He doesn't tell us specifically that, but in the book of Daniel chapter 5, verse 21, it says, as you well know, that the Lord's purpose in his ruling as he does in the kingdom of men has been seen time and time again. So God may well be dealing with the kingdoms of men, with the rulers of men here, through Gabriel and Michael in this chapter. Of course, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14 says, "Of the angels, are then of all the ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be the heirs of salvation." Now that means, of course, they could well deal with those in authority, but also is a great deal of assurance in knowing that they deal and have to do with us, through the heirs of salvation. Then in Matthew 18, verse 10, Jesus, while speaking here, gives us quite a bit of comfort when he says, "Take heed that you despise not one of these little ones, for I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." So we notice that there are angels all around us for the protection and well-being of God's people who shall be heirs of salvation. That's true of little ones, and that's true of those who are saints of God. Chapter 10 primarily then tells us about those events that we have just suggested and give us now a reason to go on into chapter 11. Verse 20, however, of chapter 10 really concludes the thoughts I had in mind. "When I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come." So really the ultimate end of chapter 10 is to tell us that Persia is going to fail and Greece is going to come on the scene. We've already seen that, of course, in previous chapters. Now, chapter 11 tells us about Greece being on the scene. He tells us about things that are taking place and are now about to come to an end as Rome comes on the scene. Now, finally. Verse 1 tells us, "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth." Gabriel still speaking. "Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." So Persia now is about to act in such ways that Greece is going to come on the scene. Persia is going to fail. Greece will be prominent, and then Greece will fail too. Will fall too. You see, we mentioned this all the way from chapter 2. So really, in the book of Daniel, we're talking about those events which took place. They were to take place, but now they have taken place between the time of Malachi and Matthew. These really are the 400 silent years where there were no prophecies or predictions or insight. And so Daniel does not give us historical facts because it hadn't happened. But Daniel tells us in prophetic terms what was to occur. So we go to secular history and try to find out what it confirmed as to what the Bible has to say. So there are going to be three kings rise in Persia. Daniel has already been told in chapter 10, verse 1, that these things were long. And verse 14 says, "Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days." I want you to note that we're talking about God's people primarily. Others will be involved, but primarily it has to do with God's people and those who at that time were considered by Daniel as the children of God, the Israelites. Now, three kings were to arise in Persia, he says, followed by the fourth king, which was to be far richer than they all. Cyrus was the one then reigning, as we noticed in the verse we had just read. So, since Cyrus was reigning, we don't count him. There'll be three kings yet to follow him. So Cyrus doesn't count in this number. The next one to follow him was Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus. He reigned for 7 years and 5 months, so history tells us. The next in turn was Smerdis, who was an impostor. He was not the rightful one to reign, but nonetheless he injected himself into the line, and he was able to reign until he was deposed for 7 months. And then after him there was Darius, the son of Hastapes. He was the son-in-law of Cyrus. He married Cyrus's daughter, who was named Mandane, and he reigned for 36 years. And then following him was a man the Bible speaks of as Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus you read of quite often in the book of Esther, for he was her husband. He was a mighty king, the Bible speaks of, as reigning over 127 provinces, stretching all the way from India on one end down to Ethiopia on the other. And this man has a very long history in secular history, very interesting history, because you know of him there as Xerxes. You don't know of him as the Bible calls him, but the secular term is Xerxes. Of course, you remember that from your study in history. And then verse 2 says, "By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up his realm against Grecia." Now, the interesting thing is that Xerxes was indeed a mighty king, and it is he who's going to be on the scene to intimidate Greece and to cause Greece to come over and conquer the Persians. But the fact is he died 100 years before Alexander came on the scene. So it's not talking about him personally doing this. It's simply telling us that it is the greatness of his kingdom, the riches of it, the glory of it, that's going to entice Alexander to want to conquer it, and of course Alexander does. But this is the king that is going to be of that nature. Now the introduction to Greece, as we have seen earlier, is as this goat, or as the one who was the brass on the image in chapter 2. Now verse 3 tells us that a mighty king shall stand up. Now this mighty king, of course, has to be Alexander, because he's in that nation which is going to take over the realm of things. Verse 3, "A mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Showing, of course, he's going to have a mind of his own and want to do as he wants to, and he will, of course. In 334 B.C., Alexander led his army eastward, and he challenged Persia, and of course, eventually conquered it, and then the world to the east of that as well. Now, as we continue on from verse 3,
I want you to notice carefully, we're going to talk about he and him over and over and over and over and over and over again. I said it that way because that's exactly the way it is. There's no end to the he's and him's. Now, normally, when you read an English sentence, as we Americans do, we can usually tie in the pronoun he or him to the subject of that sentence. And sometimes we don't have the name mentioned, but in the next sentence, the word he will take up from where the sentence before left off. So we know who we're talking about. That's not so here. This chapter is so mixed up with he's and him's and pronouns, you don't know what's going on. Actually, literally. You know, I have never tried this. I'd love to get a real good college English professor to try to tell me which is the subject of these pronouns. I doubt they could do it because it's not written that way. So don't be confused. We're going to go to secular history. We're going to try to show what the he's and him's refer to, but don't get confused by saying, well, Harry, you're not right because the subject is not here. Well, I know it's not. It's not intended that way. Now we continue on to verse 4. When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. Of course, you remember that in our study last night, we showed that Alexander was to die. His kingdom was to be divided into four parts, and it says that in the next clause, and not to his posterity, his children did not inherit, as we saw last night, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. So you see, we're repeating, really, chapter 8. That's exactly what we're doing thus far. But we're going to go much, much more in detail and lay a foundation for chapter 12. The king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. What happened, very simply, as we had mentioned last night, is that Alexander, when he died at an age of almost 33, 32 in about 8 months, almost 33, he did not have any posterity carry on. Now, he had a wife, and she was murdered by his wife, Roxanna. He had a half-brother and his half-brother's wife, and that brother began to rule for a while. But Olympus, who was Alexander's mother, had him killed. He was a half-brother to Alexander. And then Olympias was killed by the soldiers, and so that eliminates her. Alexander had a son whose name was Alexander Agus, and his mother, who was Roxanna, were slain by the order of Cassander. Now, that's one of the men you recall who took over one of the four sections of the Greek Empire. And then some 2 years later than that, Alexander's other son, Hercules, and his mother, who was Barsine, who was a daughter of Darius, was murdered by someone too. And so here we have his entire family wiped out. So he has nobody to take over, as you know from our study last night. And of course, it's the Bible here very plainly tells us. And it tells us that his kingdom is going to be divided into four sections. Now, these four sections were to be Macedon and Greece, which is in the proper area of where Greece was. Macedon would be to the north. This was to be controlled by the general whose name was Cassander. Then Thrace, or Bulgaria, as we know it today in our language, and Bithynia, which is Armenia, as we know it today, was by Lashkamas, and then Egypt was to be controlled by Ptolemy Soter, S-O-T-E-R. Now, that's the first one. There have been numerous Ptolemies, and so don't be confused when I mention that term again. This man's going to die. He'll be succeeded by others. So Ptolemy is P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. Soter is S-O-T-E-R. Now, Ptolemy is like a term for Caesar or Antiochus or a term that would be used by a number of different rulers in the same reign of a certain country. Syria now is going to be controlled by one of his generals called Seleucus Nicator. Now, Seleucus is L-E-L-E-U-C-I-U-S. Nicator is N-I-C-A-T-O-R. Now, he reigned 33 years, and he was succeeded in the year 280 B.C. by Antiochus Soter. Now, watch this. You have Ptolemy Soter, and then you have Antiochus Soter. Now, later on, we're going to find there was a Ptolemy Epiphanes as well as an Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, don't get confused, because they're all kin. They're all Greeks, And they begin to swap their names back and forth. In a marriage, you're going to see. And so when I mention Epiphanes, you begin to wonder, is it from Syria or Egypt? Now, here are the two directions involved. We have on one hand the north and one hand the south. The king of the north is going to be the king, are going to be the kings of Syria, which take the name, first of all, of Ptolemy, of Antiochus. And then the kings of the south are going to be the ones from Egypt who take the name of Ptolemy. Now, the north and south here, very plainly, as you'll see in a few moments, have to do with Palestine, and the north was Syria, and the south was Egypt. Both of these were divisions of the Greek Empire, and these two sections begin to war against each other, and that's where they begin to trample underfoot the land of Palestine. Now, so many people want to read into this, something's not there. They try to read Russia in the north and Palestine in the south. Well, you hear that everywhere you go and everywhere you look, you'll find that in writings and all kind of teachings on the television. But it just doesn't for a moment indicate it. It's not the right time for it, and it just doesn't fit, as you'll see later on in our studies. Continuing on now, we're going to find that from the fifth verse forward, the he's and the hims are going to be a lot of confusion. Now, attention, of course, are these four divisions of Greece. Is not going to be on Greece proper. It's not going to be on any other area of the Greek Empire except Egypt in the south and Syria in the north. Because the others don't affect God's people, therefore he doesn't concern himself with them. They were there, they existed, but they really were not important for our study, and so he's not going to mention those. We're going to be talking continually about the kings of the north and the kings of the south. As we continue on, we read in verse 5-6, and in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south and the shall come to the king of the north and make an agreement. So the north and the south, through their kings and the daughter of one of those, are going to be joined in marriage. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand. You see, you have she and then he. Who in the world are you talking about? Nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. You have about, if I remember right, four or five he's here, and they're talking about different people. Now let's see if we can untangle that by going to secular history. Now God's not trying to confuse us, but if he gave us all these details, the book of Daniel would be about as long as the book of Revelation, Jeremiah maybe. So he doesn't give us all the details, he gives us just enough to know when he gets to secular history what we're talking about. Well, the end of these years are going to be when these two join themselves together. Apparently, this is a marriage that takes place. Now, the king of the south is Egypt at this time, Egypt's Ptolemy Philadelphus. His daughter is Bernice. She marries Antiochus II Theos, who is now the king of Syria in the north. Now, upon a condition, though, that Antiochus put away his wife, Laodice, and her children. The fact is, then, Bernice is going to marry the king, but she said, I'm not going to marry you until you get rid of your present wife and the children you have. And so he agrees to that. He gets rid of his wife, and he marries her. But then, after Antiochus marries her, and then he decides he doesn't want her, so he'll get his first wife again, so he again marries now Laodice. But when he marries her, she begins to think about that, and she says, no, wait a minute. He got rid of me to marry her. He got her to marry me. He still might not be satisfied. I'll get rid of him. So she does. She poisons the king, and consequently, his life is ended. So that gets rid of him. And of course, the treachery involved in his marrying and divorcing and remarriage and all that went on comes to a bitter end because he is dead. Now, Laodice places her son Callinicus upon the throne. And then, at this time, we see the procedures going farther. Verse 7. Out of the branch of her roots, this is, of course, they're talking about her son now, who's still alive, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail. Now, you've had the north and south united through marriage, but it didn't work out. And there were problems here. So, Bernice's brother now, Ptolemy III, comes to power in Egypt at this time, which is 247 B.C., and he invades the north now. And the king of the north, who had died before this king did, he fell off his horse in 226. He died 4 or 5 years earlier than the king of the south. So now verse 7 and 8 is summarized in verse 9. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So here the king of the south invades the north. He defeats the king up there. He goes back to the south, and there we find him just now. He returns again after his to his kingdom in Egypt after he defeats the armies up in the north. Now verse 10 says, but his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through, then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. So, the king of the north now, who is one of the sons of the king who was murdered earlier by his mother, and by the mother apparently of this boy, he raises up against Ptolemy in the south. And his son, but he was poisoned by two of his own generals in a mutiny, is deposed. There was a problem over the wages, and they were not being paid, and so he's deposed. Now Antiochus III, who was his son, and the only remaining son, becomes a king. He retakes Seleucia and Syria and comes even to the border of Egypt in his mission in life. You see, we're just having back and forth again, over and under, armies fighting one against another, are these people who kin to each other, between the north and the south. Now verse 11 tells us, the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. So the king of the south, which at this time is Ptolemy Philopater, who had succeeded his father, shall come forth and fight with Antiochus the third, and he does. It mentions that he had here a great multitude. Now, history tells us that at this particular battle, there were 62,000 foot soldiers. There were 6,000 men on horses. This is interesting. There were 102 fighting on elephants. That's a little odd to us today, but they fought on elephants back then. So he had indeed a very great force, of course. And this is called the Battle of Raphia. It took place in 217 B.C., and the north here was defeated by the south. We go on. Verse 12. When he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. So the south is going to be victorious, as they were, but he's not going to follow through in his victory, and therefore he's not going to be strengthened by it. He's going to defeat the army, but he's not going to be able to do anything beyond that point because he doesn't follow through. And so verse 12 brings an end to his effect. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. So after 14 years, Antiochus III of the north, who's the one who's been fighting already, returns with a greater multitude and to the south. Now, his opponent had died in 204 B.C., and his five-year-old son, Ptolemy the Fifth, Epiphanes, or this is the southern man who is illustrious now, was on the throne in Egypt, which was the south. Verse 14 tells us, and in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Now many shall stand up against the king of the south. Antiochus III, the greatest, he's called, was the king of the north. And also there were, at this time, robbers of thy people. It seems to be at this time that there are going to be some internal problems in the area of Palestine, perhaps an arising of what later on in the New Testament was called the tax collectors or the publicans. There was a great deal of problems internally going on where there were tax collectors appointed, they bought their offices, and all kind of things took place now to develop the situation where the New Testament comes on the scene. The tax collector or the publican was a man who's not appreciated at all, even like we don't appreciate internal revenue people today. Now, it's possible that Isaiah might have seen this in chapter 30, but there's no direct indication that's what he's talking about. Now, some Jews would revolt, and they would join Ptolemy, and then they left Ptolemy, and they joined Antiochus III, so there was no real stability among them. At this time, however, there was from the south a general who arose, his name was Scopas. And he came and takes Palestine and Jerusalem and returns with great spoils from this area. In Jerusalem today, there is a mountain or a great hill called Mount Scopas. And there is up on top of that great hill a hotel called Hotel Scopas, if I remember correctly. Now, remember, I had been there for quite some time. I had not had a Coca-Cola in a long time. Now, the man who runs that hotel today was a friend of mine and friend of a friend of mine. And he was an Arab, but he knew Americans like Coca-Colas. And so he went out and said, would you like to have a Coke? And, of course, he gave us a real old big cold Coca-Cola, the first I'd had in about 3 weeks, and it sure did taste good. But you can look out on the top of that hotel, Mount Scopas, and see all of Jerusalem lying below you there. And it's named for this same general, and, of course, they told me about this general when I was over there, who had conquered them back at the time of this war. And, of course, they know that it was an Egyptian general who did it. Verse 15 and 16 continues on. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount, take the most spent cities and the arms of the south, and shall not withstand neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. So Antiochus III of the north now again comes with armies. He has great victory against the south, but notice now verse 16. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Now we have Antiochus III of the north. He comes down to the glorious land, which of course is Israel. He brought back those who were dispersed. He reestablished them in the land. He freed the priests and the Levites from the tributes that they were having to pay. Verse 17 tells us, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him. There again, you have a hymn that doesn't mean a thing to you just now as far as subjects are concerned. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. You know, you've heard about young kids taking sides when they choose. Well, this is where it comes from. It comes from the statement of the Bible. Well, what happens now is that he, who is Antiochus III, the great of the north, shall give him the daughter of women. So he proposed to give his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to Ptolemy V of Egypt, and he proceeded to do that. This was in 193 BC. So we have the daughter of the Syrian king, Cleopatra. She marries now the king in Egypt, who is named Ptolemy V. Now the king of the north, who was the father of Cleopatra, intended to use her and through the influence he would have through her to gain control and power over the king of the south. And that's what he wanted, and that's the reason he married her off to him, and that's the reason that this all was undertaken, but it didn't work. Because when Cleopatra went down there and married Ptolemy, she liked him. And she wouldn't work with her father and listen to her father, and so she worked against her father, and she was in agreement with her husband now, who was the king of the south. But she shall not, as it says here, stand on his side, neither be for him, talking here about her father. And so that conniving trick didn't work. But verse 18 says, after this he shall turn his face unto the owls, and shall take many, but the prince of his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease, that his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Alexander III, now the great of the north, turns his, Antiochus III, the great of the north, turns his attention to the sea. He has a navy of 100 large vessels and 200 small vessels, and he subdued many of the maritime provinces that were at that time available to him in the Mediterranean Sea. And he touched the islands of Rhodes, of Samos, of Euboea, of Salophon, and others that were in the area and conquered them. Very rarely read of sea battles, but here we have the conquest of those. He was defeated by a Roman at the Straits of Thermopylae, and that which was in Greece, and he was required to pay tribute, and his battle stopped. He was defeated. He was required to pay tribute, and he went on back home, knowing now that instead of receiving tribute from those he intended to defeat, he now has been defeated, and he was supposed to pay them tribute. But verse 19 tells us that the tables are turned. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, toward his home. But he shall stumble and fall and not be found, so he's going to die. Antiochus the Great, now the north, returns to his home, to his fort, but upon attempting to raise funds to pay the tribute that he's due to the Greeks, where he had the ways was defeated, but to the Romans where he was defeated, then apparently he died, was slain before this could be done, and so he stumbled and fell and could not succeed in what he was supposed to do. Now verse 20 tells us, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. Now Seleucus Philopator the North succeeds his father. It was his attempt to raise the necessary funds to pay off the tribute he was supposed to pay, his father was supposed to pay, and to take the, and he intended to do that by going to Jerusalem and taking the treasury from the temple there. But apparently he was killed and attempted to do so, and he never did succeed in that, so he didn't actually raise those funds either, as it shows here. Verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person, in whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. So now, Antiochus Epiphanes, the one we've been talking about early in chapter 8, and the one we're going to talk about again in chapter 12, he all of a sudden rises on the scene. So really, if you can look at what we've been talking about, I know we've been confusing, and I know it's something that it's, we've been talking about relatively fast. It would take you weeks to ever unveil all these kind of things and dig into the history of them. The fact is, what we've been doing is leading up to the time where Epiphanes comes on the scene. And when we read of him, we're going to be able to bring our thoughts to a close before very long. He now ascends to the kingship of the land. He wins his position by flattery because we want to find out he's cruel and ruthless and mean. And everything we could say about him wouldn't be too much. He pays tributes to the Romans. And possibly he's mentioned here without principle of any kind. And the word vile person, I think, denotes that. We continue on now. And verse 22, with the arms of a flood shall they be overthrown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now here we're going to find he's going to set up and tear down certain priests. Now, these priests who were the descendants of true and proper priests begin now to be bought and sold. So Antiochus Epiphanes has no scruples at all. He has no honesty at all whatsoever. And he bribes and he buys and he tears down. And anything to his advantage, he does it. So he's taking advantage of the priest of God, or who should have been the priest of God, and he corrupts them every way. So he really is just turning things inside out for evil and for sin. So this wicked and corrupt tyrant began his reign, and he is greatly against the king of Egypt in the south. And notice now the one we're talking about is from the north, and he begins now to have a great deal of effect toward Egypt. We continue on and read quite a bit before we talk again about this. Verse 23, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the provinces. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, the spoil, the riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. For they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, the king of the north and the king of the south. And they shall speak lies at one table. Now there was a time during this conflict that they did come to a conference table, and they begin to make plans for peace and harmony, but neither one of them kept the word. And there were lies spoken there, and they still cannot be at peace. But it shall not prosper, it says, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land with great riches. His heart shall be against the holy covenant. He shall do exploits and return to his own land. Verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, we've had a conflict going on between the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, the latest conflict we have is between Epiphanes in the north and the king of the south. And Epiphanes, the one we've been talking about, is a very ruthless and vile and mean person, as we well see. But he finally comes for the last time to Egypt. He takes away spoils. He's been doing that over and over again. Seems he's been very victorious time and time again. But now he goes back to Egypt again and is to take spoils. But Verse 30 tells us, "For the ships of Shittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return." Now notice, he comes to Egypt, but as he approaches Egypt this time, there's some ships on the scene he hadn't seen before. There's some ships there on the sea that all of a sudden are an obstacle to him. And so he faces a new threat, somebody he hasn't seen before, somebody that's going to arise on the scene and take over everything. Now, these are the emissaries from Rome. And so they're on the scene in 171, and he meets them face to face. He decides to go out and talk with them and decide what's to be done. He doesn't have an army that can all defeat them. They have orders from the Senate in Rome. No doubt he's been hearing about that rising power. But now they come, they meet him, they have orders from Rome that he's to turn tail and go back home. He doesn't like that a little bit. Now watch this again. "Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant." So when he met these people on the shore and they told him to go back home, he didn't like it at all. He told them that he would go and talk to his men and consider the matter. That didn't set well at all with those who had the authority from Rome, so one of them stepped forward with his staff, and he drew a circle in the sand around Epiphanes. He said, "You'll give us your answer before you step out of this circle." He wasn't about to take on Rome. He made his answer right then. He turned tail, he went back toward home, and didn't engage the Romans. That's 171. Remember we talked about that last night?